Now we hear something about exploiting supercomputers by John Fitzpatrick and Luke Jennings.
Hi guys, thanks to those of you that are here. Sorry, there's two of us speaking. I know it's only got one name on the schedule. I take it you can hear me okay. I can hear myself, yeah. So we're going to talk to you a little bit about the research that we've done over the last year and a bit on supercomputers. Basically, if anyone's spoken to me in the last year or so about anything, the conversation would have evolved into supercomputers because I don't generally shut up about it. So if you want to chat to me later about supercomputers, I'm more than happy to chat away. But out of curiosity, is there anyone here who gets to work with supercomputers day in, day out? It's not a problem. We'll introduce you to everything that we covered and we learnt in our research on supercomputers anyway. So yeah, let's get cracking. Now, most of you will look at this introduction or outline of the presentation and go, I actually don't know anything on there. It's not a problem, we'll introduce you to it as we go. But if you did work in supercomputing, you'd probably recognize everything up there. They're kind of the key technologies that are fundamental to most supercomputers that are out there. And I'd guarantee that probably 90-odd percent of the top 500 supercomputers cover at least one of these technologies. So we'll start with a bit of an introduction to supercomputing, high-performance computing, primarily with why people have them, what they're used for. Essentially, they're used in areas where there's a need to do something very computationally intensive. So things like weather forecasting, where you've got huge amounts of data that you need to do computation against. We've heard lately about things like Prism. There's a huge need to do a lot of data mining through all of the data that they're collecting. Supercomputers are great for things like that. And weapons simulation as well. There's certain legislation in place now that mean you can't just go around testing weapons arbitrarily. You need to use kit to do it, and supercomputers are the kit that they choose to do that with. So if you're anything like me, when I thought about supercomputers until fairly recently, I'd think of something like the Cray one down in the bottom, really custom bespoke hardware with real custom operating system. The reality is, and the thing that surprised me the most, is that's just really not the case. With pretty much every supercomputer out there, you're using fairly standard technologies that you or I work with every day. Things like Intel architecture, Linux operating systems are the norm. You might have GPU-based supercomputers, so NVIDIA graphics cards, that type of thing. It's all very common stuff that most of you hit every day of your lives. So just to throw some numbers at you so you see where we're getting at with supercomputers, the fastest, basically every year they publish a list of the top 500 supercomputers. Every 6 months they publish it. Currently the number one is a supercomputer called Tian-2, which is based out in China. And it's got computation power of 33.86 petaflops, which is a huge amount of computing power. But within that, it's got 16,000 compute nodes. So that's 16,000 nodes for computing whatever it needs to compute. And within each of those compute nodes, there's two Intel Xeon processors and three Intel Xeon or Intel Phi processors. Now, Intel Phis are basically Intel's answer to GPUs. So you've got a huge number of cores on them, something like 250-odd cores per Phi. So if you total that up, you've got two standard Intel processors, you've got three Intel Phis, you're coming out with a total of like 3.12 million cores in just that supercomputer. So that's massive. You've got, 1,500 terabytes of memory in there, storage of 12.4 petabytes, that's not gigabytes or terabytes, we're talking petabytes here, and all for just a measly 256 million pounds, which is probably about the same in euros. So I took a quick look at Austria's fastest supercomputer. It ranks down at 238, but you know what, it's still a fairly awesome beast there as well. So I'll hand over to Luke now, he's going to go into a bit more technical detail about things.
You all hear me okay? Yeah? Okay. So what do supercomputers do? Effectively, they implement a form of parallel computing. With any task, it can only be made as fast as the type of task it is. So if it's a serial task, it might not be able to be sped up much. And there are theoretical limits to how much you can speed up a task in parallel computing. But in practice, a lot of tasks, if coded correctly, can be sped up a lot. And that's essentially what you'll be trying to do with a supercomputer. So how do you achieve this? Well, a lot of you are probably familiar with parallel computing concepts, but mostly probably, I would guess, related to, say, multi-threaded programming, which doesn't differ too much from regular programming, because the key there is you've got a shared memory space, and you know, you've got to think about concurrency problems and locks and so forth, but otherwise it's fairly similar. With supercomputers, you've got multiple nodes that don't share a common memory interface. So one of the common ways of doing this is a framework called message parsing interface, and that achieves the kind of cluster computing goal and by implementing the concept of distributed shared memory. So a very, very basic example of using MPI you can see there, which is similar to multi-threaded sort of Hello World style programming. But under the hood, what you'll find is that to implement this, the implementation will have to figure out a way of making it look like there's a shared memory space, but by actually communicating different variables over the network. So what makes something a true supercomputer versus what you might think of as regular cluster computing? The key is not just to increase your number of cores and so forth, the number of nodes, but it's actually to achieve the same kind of speed up level on the networking front and on the file system front. So if you interconnect all those systems using some specific technologies, such as from InfiniBand or MirrorNet, you might start looking at link aggregation speeds of up to 300 gigabits a second, and then latency on the micro level, which enables you to make a much faster interface between them and start approaching shared memory speeds, even across network links. And you've got the same thing to look at with distributed file systems, multiple disks and big disk arrays, and then you can get throughput on the file system that would be that's got a much bigger speed up, which doesn't then bottleneck whatever applications you're running. Another thing to consider with supercomputers is job scheduling. So this is conventionally handled by operating systems. It's obviously a very long-running area within operating systems. In this case, you've now got a distributed system across potentially thousands or tens of thousands of nodes, and you've got to schedule jobs across them to run. And then you've got all the complexities around who gets to run what jobs when, what priorities do they get, and so forth. With supercomputers, this isn't left up to strictly the OS anymore. There's a lot of custom software around this that's generally fairly unique to supercomputing environments, such that users, for example, can write their programs using the MPI framework and submit them in some way that's then decided how and where they run and for how long and so forth. So the kind of architecture you expect to see in these environments is a simplified diagram is there. What you're likely to see is that you've got a large number of compute nodes that do the bulk of the work, and they'll be interlinked on a kind of little private network that's probably using some custom network kit, like I mentioned previously. Then probably you'll have a smaller number of those nodes that are special nodes, either as administrative nodes or login nodes, that then may be dual-homed on your conventional corporate LAN, so to speak. And then your users, for example, that are writing jobs to go on these, they may submit their jobs via some kind of web interface, or they may log into those login nodes using SSH or something and submit things from there. But so basically, you wouldn't expect all the nodes to necessarily be present on an existing normal IP LAN. You'd only necessarily probably see a few of those nodes exposed directly, but users running jobs on those hosts would obviously have visibility of the internal nodes. So based on that, there are some important security considerations for these environments. One is that users can typically connect to the login nodes, and so they can actually log in, and you've got to think about privilege escalation there. They run code on the compute nodes, so all the compute nodes, they might not be present on your normal network, but effectively they are, they're an attack surface as well. You'll have trust relationships in play. So, for example, passwordless key-based SSH is common between nodes. That might sound bad from conventional sort of security thoughts, but in this case, really, though you're looking at lots of physical systems, logically, you're looking at one system, but it can have ramifications in some circumstances, which we'll come to later. And also, job scheduling happens across many nodes, and with lots of nodes, you may need to regularly rebuild them. So, I mean, the real key implications here are local privilege escalation is actually a big deal. You know, if you've got a conventional Linux web server, probably only a few administrators might be able to log into it normally. So local privilege escalation is only normally a concern if someone's first compromised your web server, for example. But in this case, we've got a large number of users potentially that can access the system. Users have access to the inner components, so they may not be exposed on your wider corporate WAN, but if you've got lots of users that can log in and run code there, you can't really consider that a safe private network, so to speak, unless you trust all of your users. Remote imaging is pretty much essential, so you will likely see technologies to implement that, of which it's not something that's specific to supercomputing environments, but you'll obviously find that any weaknesses associated with those technologies you might see in a normal corporate environment, you could see here. And finally, several critical OS mechanisms, particularly around job scheduling, are now network accessible. So moving on to the actual technologies involved and what we've seen and found. So on the job scheduling front, we've really can divide this into two areas. There's resource managers. These tend to actually do the dirty work of actually running the jobs themselves, physically going and making them run on a system. They may then have some basic logic for how they want to schedule that. So it could be a first in, first out queue, could be a round robin or something, but they're mostly concerned with actually getting the jobs running. You then have workload managers that sit on top of that. They won't be able to run the jobs themselves directly. They need to make use of a resource manager. But on top of that, they can provide much more flexible scheduling. They can handle multiple different supercomputers, potentially running different technologies, and distribute jobs among those. And so they give you a lot more flexibility. So moving on to one example of a job scheduler. This is a workload manager, MoAB. This is quite a common commercial technology you might see out there. Looking at how this worked, we see if a user submits a job, they use a command line called msub, and that's how they submit their job, and then it runs, and then it's kind of a bit of a black box from their perspective. But looking under the hood at how this worked, we found it just basically talks to a web server using XML, and it submits various things about that job in order for it to be run. The output you see there is not exactly what you'd see in practice, but it's a simplified version that demonstrates the point. But basically, you can see it's sending the kind of user details, for example, in this case JBlogs, that the program should actually run as. It's saying what the name of the program is that should run, what nodes it should run on, and then at the bottom you'll see there's an HMAC, which is supposed to secure this, so that someone can't essentially spoof this and get something to run as any user. The HMAC does verify the authenticity of the user information submitted, but the default behavior is insecure. Basically, the key to generate that HMAC is hard-coded into the binary. But if you do want to secure it, they do provide a more secure option, which is to use what they term M-authentication. In that case, you can actually define a randomly generated key that's root-owned on the systems, only readable by root. And in this case, it will make use of a SUID root binary as part of the process, which it sends what it wants to effectively send to the web service to this SUID binary, and it says, oh, can you calculate this HMAC for me, because I need to submit this to the web server. It's not going to accept it otherwise, so could you do that? And what this SUID binary will do, it will then check who you are and try and match that up against the user information that was supplied and say, okay, yeah, you should be allowed to do this. I'll get that key and I'll sign it for you and give you your signature, or no, you're not that user, I'm not going to do that for you. So in principle, that should be secure. But if you saw before, the example I gave, there's two places where the user information is actually submitted. In testing this, we had a look at which one actually had an influence. And what we found was that one set was looked at by the SUID binary for deciding whether it was going to sign stuff, and one set was looked at by the web service to decide what it was going to actually run things as. So by changing just one set to, say, root, for example, that's not what the SUID binary looks at, it will sign it for you, and then you can submit that to the web service and get your job to run as root, which is obviously a significant flaw in the authentication process. by default, actually, root jobs aren't allowed, but you can run things as any other user. But the web service also allows for dynamic reconfiguration and using the exact same principle, but issuing configuration-related commands instead of job-running commands, you can reconfigure it to allow root jobs and then submit your jobs and run them as root on the entire cluster. So another job scheduler is Torque, which is a resource manager. I'll pass over to John for that.
Okay, so Torque is, as Luke said, it's a resource manager. It's probably the most widely used resource manager in the supercomputing world. It integrates quite nicely with Moab, which is what Luke talks about. And it's based on the original PBS project, which essentially means the code's quite old, which means it's a lot of fun for security people like me. It comes in two main flavors, the 2.5 branch and the 4.2 branch. The 2.5 branch is still the one that Adaptive, who developed this software, recommend people use on their website. However, there's been some fairly significant code changes in the 4.2 branch. And from a security perspective, I'd strongly recommend that one over 2.5. So a quick kind of overview of how it works. Essentially, user submits a job to a head node, which will be run in the PBS server service. That will do some form of scheduling and essentially end up pushing that job out to a compute node. That's how jobs are executed. It's quite a simplistic view of how it works, but effectively that's how it goes. Users interact with it via the command line. So this is a qstat command, which has basically listed all of the jobs that are running on that system. You'd use qsub in order to submit jobs to that system. Now, this was quite an interesting service, one that I wanted to target, because it's the type of service that would be exposed to untrusted networks. So I set myself up a lab. So one thing that I should probably mention about all of this, we did get access to supercomputers to play with this stuff, but an awful lot of this research we did in our own little labs at home. So this software you can pull down off the internet, you can install it in your own environment and have a play about, which is exactly what I did with this. So I wanted to target the PBS server service, and you can lock that down a little bit. You can set ACLs on the different queues, so you can specify different queues which can be accessed by different users, and you can lock them down to IP addresses and particular users and things like that. So essentially what I did was I locked down the environment as much as I possibly could so that basically no one could ever submit jobs to this service, and had a go at breaking it to see if I could get in. And I'll spoil the surprise, but I managed to get in. And I'll take you through that now. So this is our supercomputer. I'll show you, well, it's called Gibson for obvious reasons. And we've got our attacker, Zero Cool. Again, you can tell he's our attacker because of the green on black foo going on. So if we jump back to the supercomputer, obviously we wouldn't have access to this supercomputer in real life, but just to show you what Torque looks like on it. So Torque listens as a service on port 15001. Older versions, it listens TCP and UDP, but I targeted the TCP service just because that's more commonly used. And interestingly, it also runs as root. If you think about it, it's got to run as root because it's got to impersonate different users when it submits or runs their jobs. So if we manage to exploit this, we get, hopefully, a root shell on the box. So back on the attacker's machine, you can see we're running as a standard user. So I've packaged the exploit up as a Ruby script, and you can literally run the Ruby code and point it at the server. Now, just before we kick that off, demos of exploits actually can be quite boring because you go bam and then you've got a root shell. So I'll talk you through a bit of the effort that I went to get this working. It took a hell of a lot of ropping around within various libraries in order to get it working. But essentially, it's a nice, clean, solidly reliable exploit that bypasses all mitigation measures that were implemented on the remote system. So all being good, we should have a root shell popped back with us. I know it's a video, but you've still got that anticipation. So if this will work, yes. So we've got access to Gibson. Let's just check that we're root on the box. So yeah, we've popped the supercomputer, basically unauthenticated remote root on that system. Now, we'll come back to this one as well, because one root shell is not good enough for me. We'll get another one later. Ah, damn it. So yeah, unauthenticated remote root via the PBS server service on Torque. But there's also another service that's running, which is the PBS MOM, this one here. So that's the communication to that. Now, that's less exposed, but it's still an interesting one, because anyone who's able to run jobs on a supercomputer can target that service. And there's also a lot of instances I've seen where there'll be a PBS MOM running on the head node, and the head node is a node that's likely to be exposed to the wider network as well. So before I go further and talk about that, I should probably cover one of the authentication mechanisms that exists within Torque, and that's TRQ-AuthD. Now, as I explain this, you'll go, oh, that's a terrible thing. But do bear in mind, you should never be a privileged user on a supercomputer, basically. The environment should be locked down, so you shouldn't be able to perform operations like binding to privileged ports. So how TRQ-AuthD works is you establish a connection from a privileged port via a set UID Unix socket, which means the system can verify that you are legitimately able to do that. You then establish a connection from a non-privileged port, and within the privileged connection, you authenticate that non-privileged connection, and then after that, you can perform whatever operations you like. You've essentially authenticated yourself. So that's the authentication mechanism that exists when you talk to PBS server. The authentication mechanism that exists when you talk to PBS MOM looks more like this. Run this, job runs. So this is the communication channel we're about to exploit, and surprise, surprise, we can essentially literally just fire a job at the PBS MOM and it will run. So strange as it may sound, we're just gonna sue down to a low-priv user because it would be boring to get a root shell from a root user. So we'll just grab the exploit code to run it. And when this runs, you'll see the type of messages that are sent back and forth, and I can show you the bits that we're modifying. But typically, if we're running a exploit as the demo user, you'd expect it to run as a demo user. But we're going to specify that it runs as root, which shouldn't be possible. But PBS MOMs don't check to see if the job's been run as root. So we're passing a few arguments here. First of them is MOM. That's the system we want to exploit. Second, root, the username we want to run the job as. And then we're going to set up a netcat listener on port 4444. So that's run. If you take a look at the message that's been sent across, you can see the command that we've wanted to execute sits in there. And also, the user's been specified as root and the group also as root. So all being well, we should be able to netcat onto port 444 on that box, and that should give us another root shell. So yeah, we've compromised the PBS MOM, and we're also running as root on that box as well. So mass ownage of Torque. All good fun. So there's CVE reference for the second one of them that I've pushed out an advisory for. The first one's still pending, if you like. But yeah, it's not looking good for Torque. It's something I'd strongly recommend you don't expose if you're running it on your systems. So Cray systems have a similar mechanism called AP run. Works in kind of a similar manner. The architecture looks something like this. Ultimately, you run your job on the login node with the AP run command, and it shepherds it out to the compute nodes that it wants to run on. And what I'll do is we'll run this one live, because this one's quite an interesting one. But essentially, it shows you how to pop root on a Cray. So if we run the ID commands, we get our user ID back. But we can shepherd that off to a compute node to run that command on a compute node. Obviously, in real life, we'd be running more complex jobs than ID, but for the sake of this demo, we'll just run ID. So on the compute node, we've run our job as UID 1001. If we want to run this as root, If we jump in a debugger, some of you can probably see where this is going. We'll set a breakpoint on the call to get UID. And if we run the ID commands, we hit our first breakpoint. So this is the point the AP run is making its first call to get UID. Essentially, it makes a syscall. But if we step through a couple, I've missed it. So let me start that one again. So we step through a couple of instructions. Now it's a 64-bit program. So the result is returned in the RAX register. So if we simply set RAX to be 0, continue through, it makes a couple of other calls to get UID, but we're not interested in those ones. And essentially, when things finish up, we've basically runtime patch AP run to give us a root shell on a compute node for Cray, which I thought was quite cool. Now, to give full credit to Cray on this one, I reported this to them on a Friday evening. They got back to me 2 minutes later, had a good conversation. Cray basically must have a policy where they only employ lovely people, because everyone I spoke to at Cray was really, really nice. So I explained the issue to one of their security team. She said, thank you very much. I got home to another email where she basically said I couldn't explain it very well to the developer. Are you able to give her a call? So I had a good long chat with the developer. She dropped me an email Sunday, basically over the weekend saying, thanks for that info, John. I've fixed the issue. So I'm sure many of you have worked with vendors before, and a turnaround time of literally a day to fix a patch is quite exceptional. Good stuff to them. So that is now patched. So if you've got a Cray, it's probably worth applying the patch for that one. So yeah, that was popping a root shell on Cray. I'm going to hand over to Luke now, who's going to talk through some OpenMPI stuff.
Okay, so we mentioned MPI before. This is an example of it being run. So if someone was using MPI run to run, just say, uname on a bunch of different, on a couple of different systems, it would redirect the standard output, for example, and you would see, the hostname output coming back from two systems, for example, in this case, node and localhost. At the bottom, this is running an actual custom MPI-enabled program, a Hello World kind of example, where they exchange some data between one another, but a similar principle. Now, I assumed it was going to be using SSH to run the commands on the other systems, and that would seem like the easy way. Tracing the program flow, I found that it did, to some extent, but it actually ran this command called ORTID. And there was no specification of what program was to run besides that in the initial SSH string, but there was, importantly, a TCP connect back string and an ID number of some sort, so you can see highlighted at the bottom. So looking into that further, using Wireshark, tracing the packets, you can see that on that connect back IP, it was a custom binary protocol with various information in it. But importantly, you can see in the highlighted bit that the program name, in this case, Hello World, cropped up within the protocol. Now, this is clear text. So obviously, it does beg the question of, well, does that just mean it's vulnerable to a blatant man-in-the-middle attack to get code execution? And yes, in principle it is. But if we remember previously when we were discussing architecture, in a very simplified architecture, we've basically got something that looks like this. Now, most traffic interception techniques, you generally need to be kind of root to be able to manipulate network packets, to be able to gain control, for example, like ARP spoofing or so forth. In this case, we're kind of expecting that people aren't root, they'll be logged into nodes as low privileged users and they're looking to escalate. And additionally, the network that we're talking about that they're on is one that's generally only accessible within the data centers. It's not like something you can easily just go and plug your laptop into, or if you can, you're probably in a position where you physically own the boxes anyway. So the question was, is this really a concern in the realistic environments we would see? I questioned, is it exploitable in the case of being a low privileged user on one of these nodes? So I thought, what if I connect to the port first before the remote node? Will the master node give up listening? And in that case, can I hijack the port? Will that be a race condition of some kind? And even if I could do that, could I realistically win the race, for example? Well, I thought in this case, if I am able to listen on that port, the legitimate workflow involves an SSH connection to another server and then a TCP connect back, whereas I could be running locally on the same host this all starts on and do everything localhost. So with no proper network comms, localhost only, technically I would have the speed advantage. But the other question is, what about this ID number? Now, looking into this further, it turns out you don't just need to know the address and port to connect back to, but you do need to know this ID number, which is a significant stumbling factor. But the reality of the matter is, this is passed as an argument, and generally, through the proc file system, much like when you run PS, you'll find that you can actually see the system arguments passed to certain functions. Now, you can restrict this information, and you can do things against this, but generally, on most Linux systems, by default, you'd find this to be the case, and it was certainly the case in the ones we looked at. So, my idea for an exploit for this was, to see if it's realistic, monitor the proc file system in real time. Whenever you detect an SSH connection, read the port number and the application-specific ID. As soon as you do that, as quick as you can, connect to the port, talk MPI to it enough that it's happy with the correct ID, that it stops listening and thinks that the remote load has started execution of the program, at which point we quickly bring up our interface, listen on that port, and when we do get a connect back from the remote node, we talk MPI to it, but submit our own command of our own choosing with our own arguments to get it to run that and effectively compromise the. So I'll just give a quick demo now. So this is basically what we saw before if we use an MPI run normally. So running hostname, for example, that's running it on two systems, local host and compute node one. Now if we run an MPI-enabled program, we might see a little bit more output, but it's the same principle that applies. Now, in this case now, we'll move to a different tab, run as a low-privileged user, and we'll run a Python script, which is monitoring the proc file system, as we mentioned before. And then just in case our exploit is successful, we'll set up a netcat listener that's waiting for a connectback shell. Now we go back to what we had before, and we run the exact same command we did previously. Now, you can already see something slightly different happen because the user ID on the second line that's come back is different, which is the ID of the nobody account, than it was before. That's a byproduct of where we've connected first as a different user and gone through the MPI process. But if you then look, if we look back at our script, okay, that's a lot of debug output, but you can see it's been intercepting some of those commands. And then if we move over to finally our other tab, we can see we've got a connection from the remote node. If we run ID then and hostname, we can see that we are root on the remote compute node one. So that's basically successful exploitation of that vulnerability, but specific to the environment in this case, in that there's no dependency on being root to do traffic interception techniques or something. This is purely done as a low privileged user. Okay, I'll now pass over to John for distributed file systems.
So as Luke said earlier, in order to be a supercomputer, everything's got to be properly quick, and that's the same for file systems as well. When you talk file systems on supercomputers, you're talking gigabytes, gigabits a second. And there's three key file systems that I've come across in my work with supercomputers: GPFS, Lustre, and NFS. Now, being security people, we've all heard of NFS and its various flaws. GPFS is IBM's offering. It's damn expensive. I've had a chance to do bits and pieces of work with it, but yet to do it in a huge amount of depth. Luster is the one we're going to take a bit more of a look at, because Luster's very, very widely used. A lot of people resell it in appliances. I believe Cray's all come with a Luster appliance in it to provide file systems for their compute nodes. And about 60% of the top 100 supercomputers are using Luster in some form. Now, I'll talk quickly through how the architecture works for Luster. Essentially, you've got your Luster clients, so they're the computers that have mounted the Luster file system. So they could be the compute node supercomputers. They could even be workstations. But you've got kind of a separation of roles in the environment. You've got the metadata server, which is responsible for maintaining details about the files. So things like file systems, last access times, that type of thing. The OSS is actually where the raw data is stored. So you access the raw data via the OSS. So essentially, if you want to read a file, you go, right, well, you speak to the metadata server, ask if you can read it, and if it says yes, you read it from the OSS. Now, I was going to show a demo here, but we're quite tight on time, so I'll basically explain it. But you might also be asking yourselves the same question I asked. Basically, I found this vulnerability by reading the documentation, and the question in my mind was, well, if I ask the metadata server if I can read this file, and it says no, what happens if I just read it anyway? So you thought NFS was bad. So yeah, it turns out with Luster, you can literally just arbitrarily read files, do a huge amount of stuff. It's a real pain to work with, so I've only managed to get as far as just reading files. I'm certain you could write files as well. Now, I didn't want to overhype the impact of this vulnerability, because as we've already talked about, in most supercomputer environments, if you've got access to Luster, you ought not to be a privileged user like root. And at the moment, I've only been able to perform this attack as root. But in reality, the more people I speak to, the more I realize that Luster's far more exposed than that. And this is a reasonably significant issue. And then throw into the mix, for example, I said all Crays have Luster stuff in them. And we've just shown how to pop a root shell on a Cray. So kind of combine it all, it's perhaps quite problematic. But there's some projects going on that might resolve these issues over time. So if you want to see the demo, grab me later, but ultimately it's probably better described than in a video anyway. So yeah, kind of slowly wrapping up, I'll hand back to Luke to talk about some cluster management issues that we've come across too.
Okay, so this one's really considering the environment that we see as well. So we spoke about how generally you wouldn't expect to be root on these nodes, or if you are, you own everything already anyway. Within these environments, it's not just the compute nodes and login nodes and so forth that you actually see. Sometimes you'll see other bits of kit. So you might see little appliances that control the disk arrays, or little appliances that control fans on the racks across all the nodes and so forth. Often these are actually, though they shouldn't be that sensitive on their own, they may be little embedded Linux systems that aren't particularly secure. And if you compromise one of those, you find that you've got root on a Linux system on the same network as everything else. And suddenly all the assumptions we were making before about not necessarily being able to perform certain attacks because we shouldn't be root become feasible when you own something that's supposed to just control fans. But also, we discussed before cluster management. You're not going to manually rebuild 20,000 nodes, for example. You're going to need some automated way of doing it and doing it consistently. So this is common in corporate environments in general anyway, Pixie booting and so forth. We've seen a couple of different vendor implementations of this. Both use Pixie and TFTP as a first stage to this, as is common. One of them used its own custom protocols, including multicasting, for its second stage. The other used more common protocols like rsync. So there's a couple of things to take home from this. I mean, obviously, this type of technology makes it very difficult to secure directly. But there's a few key things to take into account. One, very importantly, you need read-only images. Otherwise, someone's going to backdoor those images. TFTP, for example, isn't an authenticated protocol, so you can just control read-only or write. If you go and make your images writable, you've got a serious problem. But also, you need to make sure that there's no sensitive information in the images themselves. You've kind of got to work to the assumption of no confidentiality. It's very difficult to stop someone getting their hands on those images, at least for reading. So, for example, we mentioned before about passwordless-based SSH, for example. don't leave root's private SSH key without a password within the image, because if someone gets read access to that, then they've got access to everything. Similar for MOAB key files or certain other information that may be sensitive. In general, this information, if it's needed to be on the images, can be added as securely as a post-imaging step with scripts. So leave root's public key in the authorized keys file, sure, image that, and then as a first step with your script after that, log in as root and then put the SSH key on the real host, but don't leave it in the image that you accept will be readable off your TFTP share, for example. Another issue, final one, really, is local privilege escalation. We mentioned this was very important earlier. This, you know, in Unix environments, this is obviously a very widely discussed area. There's lots of things to consider, file permissions and various things. But specifically in this case, we saw a lot of cases of a vendor-added attack surface, effectively, you know, custom binaries on the system that you wouldn't normally see on a regular install. On one manufacturer default install, we saw two non-standard SUID root binaries, which obviously are fairly interesting to start with. One looked particularly interesting because it had an extractor directory option. Now, the idea here is that, well, if it's extracting something as root because it's SUID root, can we control what's being extracted? And does that mean, if so, we could turn a file write into root code execution? Well, when run normally, it listed something that looked a little bit like the following, which was a little bit cryptic. But the file names at the end were basically the contents of the current directory. After a lot of investigation, a bit of reverse engineering of it and so forth, we discovered that that was a custom way of encoding the ownership and file permissions on those files. And the extractor directory option took that output, and took that as an input and changed the current file permissions and ownership on any files that matched that in the current directory. So, obviously, if you go in on your own system, create something like that, a SUID root bin shell, you run that tool to get what the output is, and then you go to your remote system, you're going to compromise and supply that, it'll make your root shell in your own directory for you, and then you can just run that and escalate straight to root. Very simple but stupid vulnerability, but a very serious one in these environments. The take-home point for this in these environments really is to make sure you identify any manufacturer-added attack service and remove it where you can. I mean, in this case, both these binaries didn't seem to need to be SUID root. In fact, they didn't even seem to need to be there full stop. They were involved in the imaging step and didn't need to be on the final image. But it's a very important thing to consider. Okay, I'll just pass back to Song, just John, to summarize.
And I'm going to summarize quickly because I can see the out of time thing. Basically, we had awesome fun playing with supercomputers. There's some interesting challenges. Security is something that's important, but obviously you don't want to spend $250 million on a supercomputer and then massively degrade its performance by encrypting everything and bits and pieces like that. But as you'll have seen from some of the vulnerabilities that we identified, there's certainly things that most definitely could be done to secure things up without impacting performance at all. So definitely some interesting challenges. I suspect we probably don't have time for questions, but I'm going to be around for the rest of the con. Oh, we do have time for questions. Okay, we've got time for questions. And Luke, you can be the runner because you've got the microphone. Save your job.
Hey, I noticed a lot of Unix stuff. Doesn't Microsoft also have an HPC offering? And do you guys know much about that? Have you seen it in any use? And if so, does it have like its own distributed file system, et cetera, as well, and its own unique set of vulnerabilities, et cetera?
So yes, Microsoft do have their own HPC offering. We've never looked at it, primarily because I've never met someone who uses it. But if someone who does use it wants us to take a look at it, I'd love to. I suspect there'd be similar, we'll have a chat later then. I suspect there'd be similar types of issues, but the reality is I honestly don't know. Anything else? No? In which case, thanks very much, guys. Cheers.